From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The news this week was the passage of tougher sanctions against Iran. But it was hard not to see the symbolism in the timing. Almost exactly a year after disputed elections in Iran sparked massive protests that captured the world's attention. Last summer, the images of protesters, members of what was dubbed the Green Movement, roused American sympathies. For a while. But by the new year, the images and the story seemed to fade away. Now, a year later, many journalists, especially Iranian Americans, are taking stock. Reza Aslan is one such reporter, author most recently of Beyond Fundamentalism: Confronting Religious Extremism in the Age of Globalization. He argues that the U.S. media got the story wrong. How they got it wrong depended on who was doing the reporting or analysis.
It almost became a Rorschach test of sorts for the media. If you were on the conservative side of the spectrum, then you saw this as the best hope that the United States had in dealing with Iran's nuclear ambitions. If you were on the liberal side, you saw this as young secularists finally standing up to the theocrats that ruled that country. Well, nothing could be further from the truth. It was actually quite a diverse, eclectic movement.
So break it down for me. All these different people with different aims in mind when they took to the streets.
We had young secularists from North Tehran and the rich suburbs of Isfahan. But at the same time, you had very conservative people from Mashhad and from Qom, the religious capital. You had the business class, the merchants, who felt as though the international isolation that has become so much worse under Ahmadinejad had really taken a bite out of their profits. You had the traditional clerical establishment who felt as though the rapid militarization of Iranian politics had pushed aside the religious fabric of society. And what they all had in common with each other is this fundamental agreement that the Islamic Republic as it exists today was neither Islamic nor a republic.
So you talked about the commentators and the pundits who each ran with a particular thread and built their entire narrative around it. What was your thread? And did you get it right?
So many of us Iranian Americans were so deeply affected by what we were seeing. I have to say, we were just as swept along in the excitement and the revolutionary fervor about what was happening in our own country. And for myself, who actually lived through the revolution in 1979, it was quite easy to see the parallels.
But in the simplest terms, the average news consumer was told that there was this great movement in the street and that perhaps the Iranian regime could fall. Was it ever a possibility?
It was never a possibility, and it's still not a possibility. That was never really a goal of the Green Movement. It was to delegitimize the regime so that it could be reformed.
So if many in the U.S. had the impression that the regime was teetering on the brink, then, of course, comes the backlash. It didn't. Therefore, the movement is dead. And that's the narrative that we hear quite a bit right now.
That's right. I mean, once the Green Movement didn't do what we wanted it to do, what we thought it would do, then it was very easy to just simply declare it dead and move on. The truth is the Green Movement has been remarkably successful in delegitimizing the Iranian regime in its current iteration in the eyes of the vast majority of Iranians. And it's time for Iran's leaders to decide, are they going to continue to pretend the people have a voice in their government, or are they going to become a full-scale military dictatorship? This is a government that is deathly afraid of its people. It is, after all, a government that came into power on the heels of a popular revolution.
Do you think anything has changed 1 year on about how Iranian politics is covered in the U.S.?
Perhaps the greatest legacy of the Green Movement is that it's finally proven to Americans and to the mainstream media that Iran is an incredibly complex political society. And more than anything else, it showed that the old view of Iran being run by a single man in a turban simply does not work anymore.
So where do you think interested news consumers can find all of those different voices so they can put together a nuanced contextual picture of what's going on there.
Well, I think that the average consumer of news is going to have to figure out a way to broaden the access that they have to different sources. Imagine if 20 years ago, those Chinese kids who gathered by the thousands in Tiananmen Square, imagine if they had Twitter. In 1989, the Chinese government was able to simply create a complete media blackout. But even after the Iranian government kicked out every single foreign journalist, we knew exactly what was happening in Iran, who was being arrested, who was being killed. We knew what was going on in the backroom discussions in the parliament, thanks to the people on the ground who were giving us this information, not just through Twitter, but through emails, through mobile phone exchanges. The only way that the Iranian government ultimately was able to control the flow of information out of Iran was to literally pull the plug, including government access to the internet. That is unsustainable.
Reza, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Reza Aslan is the author most recently of Beyond Fundamentalism, Confronting Religious Extremism in the Age of Globalization.
The image that symbolized the violence of Iran's post-election chaos was that of a young woman named Neda Aga Sultan shot and killed during a protest in Tehran. On June 14th, HBO will air For Neda, a documentary about who she was in life and what she came to represent as the video of her death swept the globe online. Perhaps the most revealing parts of the film are the first ever on-camera interviews with her family.
According to her mother, Neda was a rebel, almost from the moment she was born.
From the age of 3, she never accepted control. She fought with the school authorities not to wear a chador, and she won that battle.
For the film's producers, finding Neda's family was a very difficult feat. They needed an Iranian journalist to help them, but the Islamic regime wouldn't look too kindly upon reporters seeking interviews with the parents and siblings of the victim of that very public act of brutality. Every journalist declined the producer's request, except one. Saeed Kamali Dehan. Saeed was living in London when he was approached about finding Neda's family. He'd left Iran because he'd been threatened by intelligence officials for his reporting after the election.
I was very frustrated and guilty. I'm in London and everybody else is in Tehran. So at the time that I received this proposal from HBO and from Anthony Thomas, the director, I instantly said, yes, I will go.
So you get to Iran, and you manage to get through security with your cameras intact, and now your job was to find Neda's family. How did you go about locating them?
Well, when I was in London, I started research on how I can contact family, because I knew where they were living, but I didn't have any phone numbers. I met Neda's brother.
How did you meet him?
Without letting him know, I went to his office, and he works for a travel agency, and I pretended to be someone who is looking to book a flight. I sat down on a chair, and I told him the story that I'm coming from London, and I want to film your family for a documentary about Neda. And he told me that he needs to talk to his family, and especially Neda's mother. And after 4 days, I received a message that the family have agreed to meet me.
So you go to their flat, not knowing whether the place is being staked out by security forces, and you walked in and you looked around. What did you see?
Suddenly, I saw Neda's photo on the wall, and I burst into tears. You know, before that, I was very nervous of whether I would be arrested when I'm entering their house, or how can I persuade a family to do this. But suddenly, I was there. I was in Neda's house. At that time, Neda's family had to calm me down instead of me calming them down. At some point, I went to her bedroom. That was a very moving experience, you know, to see her bedroom, to see her dolls and, you know, her books and her makeup. Before that, she was like the superhuman hero. And suddenly she emerged as an ordinary girl that I've met thousands of times in the streets of Tehran. There were lots of them who were killed and we don't know their stories because their death didn't attract our attention.
The HBO film has aired in Iran. Voice of America showed it. The regime tried to jam the signal, which Iranians can get through illegal satellite dishes. Voice of America is planning to re-air the show this week. Now, from the beginning, the regime tried to fight back. with various stories of its own about Neda and about her death. First, they said, well, she's not dead, she's alive. And then they said, well, it was actually the CIA behind the shooting.
Are you seriously accusing the CIA of killing Neda?
The bullet that we found in her head was not the bullet that you could find in Iran.
And then she was murdered by a BBC correspondent. No, no, no. Then she faked her own death, according to another documentary, this one produced by the state TV.
How did Nedava Sultan really die? According to the documentary, forensic evidence and statements by security officials show Neda was not killed in the way shown by Western media.
I don't think the majority of Iranians would believe the regime version of stories, not only about Neda's story, but about everything else. But we still have people in rural places. They are not very well educated, and they don't have access to the satellite or internet. Let me give you one example. My mother, she doesn't have any access to internet or satellite, and she didn't believe that Neda's death happened. And I was the Guardian reporter in Tehran. Because the only media that she had access to was the state-run TV. But after our film, she watched my documentary, and her view to Neda's story changed.
When your odyssey began, you were in London, having been warned by Iranian state security to watch yourself, and feeling guilty. Well, you went in, you played a critical part in filming this documentary. Now you're back in London with zero chance of being able to re-enter your country. That's quite a sacrifice that you've made.
It's getting harder and harder for me because I don't have that access to my friends and my relatives as much as I had before. But Iranians, they're trying very best to continue this struggle. And that was the least I could do. There are still people who are in prison in Iran or raped or tortured. So I'm really not in a bad situation in comparison to their situation.
All right. Saeed, thank you very much.
No problem.
Saeed Kamalindahan is a co-producer of HBO's documentary For Neda. It will air on HBO June 14th.
Coming up, can AT&T stop the digital revolution in its tracks?
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield with a few of your letters. We got a powerful response, not surprisingly, to our debate between Stephen Rosen and Peter Beinart over whether honest criticism freely expressed ever poses a danger to a democratic nation, specifically Israel. Robert Potter of Manalis, New York, disagreed with how we address this question, quote, "This debate isn't about that question. It's about whether support for Israel should be blind to Israel's faults." He goes on, "OTM has turned the troubling issue of the flotilla raid into should we love Israel a whole lot or should we love it utterly and completely?"
But Mary Kay Office of Salt Lake City wrote, quote, "Bravo for sharing this intelligent, passionate, and moving debate with all of us who are devoted listeners to On the Media. A unique opportunity to hear both sides expressed eloquently and respectfully, yet in fierce opposition. Perhaps that eloquent respect, in spite of profound differences, is the pragmatic solution?" However, most of the comments centered on who won the debate, and that seemed to depend on who was listening. For instance, Marsha Kunin from Massachusetts wrote, quote, "How refreshing and unusual and wonderful to hear on National Public Radio Stephen Rosen's brilliant characterization of the dilemma Israel faces and his clear-headed articulation of the blindness to reality of the likes of Mr. Beinart."
While Jack Smothers of San Diego wrote, quote, "Kudos to On the Media for having such a debate, and kudos to Mr. Peter Beinart for voicing the concerns of the silenced Jews who favor a more balanced approach to U.S.-Israeli dialogue. The war hawks in Israel would have you believe that any criticism of Israel makes you anti-Israel, but there couldn't be anything further from the truth." Thanks for your comments. Keep them coming to onthemedia.org. Or for more back and forth with OTM, follow us on Twitter or join our Facebook page.
Oh. On Monday, Apple CEO Steve Jobs unveiled the latest version of the iPhone, a big deal that seemed to distract attention from what was potentially a much bigger deal, an announcement by AT&T, the exclusive wireless network for the iPhone and the iPad, that new AT&T customers would no longer be able to sign up for unlimited data plans. Pre-existing AT&T customers can hang on to their old unlimited plans, but for all new converts to the iPhone or any other smartphone on the AT&T network, there will be a limit as to how much video, music, apps, and news you can stream over the air. The Wall Street Journal last month quoted a Verizon representative hinting that soon Verizon may also move away from unlimited data plans. AT&T says this is good news. Most users will pay less since they can choose between two plans, $15 a month for 200 megabytes or $25 a month for 2 gigabytes. Before, everyone had to pay $30 a month for the unlimited plan. But Jeff Jarvis, blogger at BuzzMachine.com, says AT&T's new scheme is cynical and that having no limit is crucial to the progress we've made since the early days of internet service on our home computers.
The irony here is that it was AT&T back in the 90s that went to a 1995 unlimited plan. And that's when suddenly your spouse no longer said, "Are you still on that internet thing, wasting a fortune?" Now the clock was gone. What did we do? We browsed. We saw the whole internet. It led to an explosion of internet use, an explosion of internet development, and an explosion of the internet business model. Now, just as mobile is set to go nuclear, AT&T ironically turns the clock back on us, and it makes us nervous about being there. And the reason it's a cynical act is because listen to Jon Stewart a few months ago when he went after AT&T and its bad service.
How do you drop 4 calls in a 1 mile stretch of the West Side Highway? There's no building around. What does the open space confuse AT&T's signal?
AT&T could do 2 things. It could invest in its network and make it better, or it could get its customers to use the network less.
But with wired connections, internet providers could just lay new cables. With wireless connections, there are limits to the bandwidth. So shouldn't the bandwidth hogs have to pay for their gluttony?
I just got back from South Africa, where it was very expensive to use my AT&T iPhone, and I was constantly nervous about everything I did. And I remember that's how I used to feel in the early days of the internet, when we'd go on to, remember, AOL or CompuServe, and we'd worry about that hourly charge that would come in every month. Well, I think that's going to hurt the internet and the entire economy now. We have all kinds of new devices that are coming out to say, use me, make more video, watch more video, beautiful movies on the iPad. And now we're being told at the same time, oh, not too much now.
How much is 2 gigabytes?
It's not that much. You watch video and you get photos and you take photos and you share stuff and you create content which has great value. And the problem is we're all going to do all of that less.
Well, how about this? You can transfer your data when you get home by connecting your phone to your computer with a cord, or when you get to a Wi-Fi hotspot instead of using the cell phone company's network. This could just force people to be a little bit smarter and transfer data at the right time and in the right place.
Right time, right place. Who set these rules? This is the internet. I want to be connected to the internet through my laptop and an iPad and through my car, through my house, through everything. And the industry and the economy want that for me. It's growing. It's exploding. There are things we haven't even imagined yet we can use. And you're trying to put me through all these hoops. That just does not bode well for the development of this new thing.
You say that it's very cynical because this is the moment when mobile digital technology is about to go nuclear. But Jeff, maybe it already has. Maybe wireless companies think the genie is already out of the bottle. People already depend on their phones for data. In other words, the revolution has started, and even charging for data isn't going to slow it down.
What did you use that word, phone? How outmoded that is, right? The funny thing here is that I don't want their voice plans anymore. So fine, you know what, AT&T? Let me get rid of my voice plan and let me use Skype. Let me go 100% digital. Let me pull together all of my accounts in one and have a world where I can connect like mad and pay you for it and not pay for things that I don't want.
So you're saying that you'd be able to live with a data cap if you didn't have to pay for voice service?
I'd rather pay a lot of money for unlimited data and not pay for all the other stuff I don't use. That's a model I can get behind.
If they said, I'm going to charge you $50 a month and you can have unlimited, you'd probably go ahead.
Sold.
Right. But a lot of people need access at a lower level just to function in life, and maybe they don't have $50 a month.
I'm not against having lower plans, but eliminating the unlimited plan, that's my problem.
I see. Let's say Verizon does follow suit. You still have T-Mobile. You still have Sprint. They could offer unlimited plans. If this is really such a horrible idea, won't other companies offer competitive services and keep the mobile revolution moving forward?
If this show were called On the Airlines, the same logic would be, well, if one airline raises its prices, won't the others take advantage of that and lower theirs? No, it's an oligopoly. We're stuck with them.
It's increasingly important to modern life to be connected to the internet. In fact, it's nigh on to essential. If that's the case, isn't the next logical step to make it a public utility? Pay for it with taxes?
Well, I think in the short term, because we have a quadrupoly of access in mobile and we have a monopoly or a duopoly in most of our neighborhoods in terms of wired internet, then there may be a short-term need for regulation. But the founders of Google have said that taking the white spaces that'll be freed up when digital TV takes over from analog TV and turning that into Wi-Fi on steroids would create connectivity we can't imagine.
Didn't we already do that? Didn't all our TVs already go digital last year?
But we haven't reallocated some of the spectrum yet and figured out what to do with it. If we left it unregulated like Wi-Fi and had Wi-Fi on steroids, the founders of Google say we'll have connectivity everywhere. Then we'll have competition. And I believe that competition is what will take care of this. So the priority is to get more people offering us access in more ways, and then we'll have good deals.
Jeff, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Jeff Jarvis teaches at the City University of New York Graduate School of Journalism, and he also blogs at buzzmachine.com.
Helen Thomas, erstwhile dean of the White House Press Corps, resigned under pressure this week.
Any comments on Israel? We're asking everybody today. Any comments on Israel?
Tell them to get the hell out of Palestine.
Ooh. Any better comments on that?
Helen is one.
Remember, these people are occupied, and it's their land. It's not German, it's not Poland.
So where should they go? What should they do?
They go home.
Where's the home?
Poland.
So the Jews,
Germany.
You think the Jews go back to Poland and Germany?
And America and everywhere else.
Well, that's an ignominious way to end a career, with a callous, stupid soundbite delivered no less to a rabbi on the occasion of Jewish Heritage Month. Who knows what motivated Helen Thomas's remark? Maybe it was her disgust with Israeli policy. Maybe it was hitherto closeted antisemitism. Maybe it was old age and the impunity that tends to offer for all manner of geriatric obstreperousness. Or maybe it was Helen Thomas just being Helen Thomas to a fault. This program has no opinion on whether this White House pressroom institution should be consigned to everlasting disgrace, but we do wish to observe that her crankiness helped keep presidents of the United States honest, or at least markedly less regal, for 50-some years. Here she is grilling Ronald Reagan.
The experts say that the Russians are far ahead of us in some nuclear weaponry, and we are far ahead of them in terms of the Polaris missile and so forth. And we also have the capability of swift, massive retaliation against the Soviets. Under those circumstances, why don't we seek negotiations for a freeze now and carry on to reductions? That way we can halt the making of doomsday weapons and save billions to help poor people.
Helen, I know that there are people that have tried to figure this out. The truth of the matter isn't much of an incentive.
Saying that we are vulnerable now, right today, to a nuclear attack that we could not retaliate on?
Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, Ford, Carter, Reagan, Bush, Clinton, Bush, and Obama. She treated them all with perfunctory respect, but very little deference. Had her colleagues seen her less as a gadfly and more like a role model, I can think of a number of messes this country might have avoided.
Ms. Thomas,
President, you started this war. It's a war of your choosing, and you can end it alone today. Don't you understand? We brought the Al-Qaeda into Iraq.
Actually, I was hoping to solve the Iraqi issue.
Vice President Joe Biden threw a beach-themed party for select members of the Washington Press Corps and their families at his residence last weekend. Reporters frolicked with Biden and Obama's chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, while other senior White House officials took aim at the press with water guns. Some media critics argued that the pictures posted of the event were just more evidence of the palsy-wowsy relationship between the White House and the press that's supposed to be holding it accountable. CNN's senior White House correspondent Ed Henry's beach party tweets and video drew particular attention in the blogosphere. Ed, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks, Brooke.
So I was looking at your Twitter feed. Rahm was chasing Mrs. Biden, and she hid behind me, so I got in the crosshairs. A little girl just hit the VP in the face with some water. You can see how this might make people who want a challenging press corps that holds the feet of power to the fire distinctly uncomfortable.
No, I don't, actually. I think people are losing a sense of humor sometimes. I mean, I posted a tweet about Vice President Biden sliding down a water slide with some kids. I added, I think in all caps, exclusive video. The notion that we're working 24/7, holding their feet to fire every single second, and you can't actually stop to have a conversation, or God forbid, go to the vice president's house, somehow democracy is compromised. I think people have to look at the whole picture. If you look, for example, at what I do on a daily basis with Robert Gibbs in the briefing room at the White House, I hardly think that Robert Gibbs thinks that I give him an easy time, or that going to a White House holiday party with the president, which pretty much everyone in the White House press corps and a lot of people from New York and other cities who comment on politics, et cetera, show up for those parties too. And I hardly think that they're compromised. I just think that you've got to look at the whole big picture, not just one event. And if some people were offended or thought it was silly, have at it. Everyone's got the freedom to do that.
I don't think the concern that most people have is that it was silly or that you aren't working somberly at holding people's feet to the fire 24/7. It's that these events are so cozy. There is a kind of a Stockholm syndrome that happens in Washington.
Sure.
I worked there for 13 years, and it's all about access. It's not so much about digging, especially within the actual White House press corps itself. It's about returned calls, and that's a transaction.
Well, there's no doubt that you need access to get information, but I think that you've got to be careful assuming that just because you go to somebody's house, it's quote-unquote cozy. People we cover are not one-dimensional characters, and when you stand afar and say, I'm never going to get a drink with someone, I'm never going to have a meal, I'm never going to go to a party at the vice president's house, it seems a little odd to think that somehow you lose all scruples. I think having a meal with someone that you cover actually gives you a lot more perspective on not only who they are, but why they're attacking a certain issue a certain way. I mean, some people want to cover, whether it's the White House or the mayor's office or whatever, from thousands of feet away without really getting to know the people they cover. That may be their approach. It's not mine.
There are something like a half dozen black tie events with Washington and the press corps every year, if not more. It's about creating personal relationships that can get in the way of coverage. I mean, exactly why people are kept from covering certain beats if they find that there's a personal relationship. Those sorts of rules seem to get suspended in Washington, and I think that creates a great deal of suspicion among news consumers.
It may lead to suspicion by some outside the Beltway, especially if you sort of characterize it that way, but I hardly think going to a black tie dinner with people we cover is going to compromise our ethics either. Are there people who cross the line? Sure. But I think as long as you're careful about it, you know, to think that you go to a black tie dinner with the president or with a senator, that somehow then you're just going to close your eyes to any wrongdoing that they may be involved in. I think if we just worry about any particular critic's impression, we couldn't do our jobs at all, because we'd constantly be worrying, oh gosh, which blogger on the left is going to say this, which blogger on the right is going to say that.
It's not a small thing. It's about the credibility of the press corps.
Sure, it's a serious issue, but just because someone's blogging about it doesn't mean that there is a coziness, and it doesn't mean that their criticisms are all true.
If these events don't influence coverage, why do you think the White House throws them? Do they just want to shoot you with a super soaker?
Maybe they want to actually get to know us as people sometimes. You know, sitting down having lunch with a member of Congress, you can actually learn a lot more than you can in, say, a two-minute conversation in a hallway.
Do you ever think twice about going to these events?
Sure. You always want to be, as you say, skeptical and see what the motives are. But he's the Vice President of the United States. If he wants to invite you over to his house, I don't see why you wouldn't at least listen.
Ed, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ed Henry is the senior White House correspondent for CNN.
Coming up, how you happen to know that you have the right to remain silent. And a journalist who found his true vocation in the clink.
This is On the Media from NPR.
On the Media comes from LendingTree, whose financial tools include Loan Coach, offering personalized advice for every step of the lending process at LendingTree.com. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law.
You have the right to speak to an attorney and to have an attorney present during any questioning.
If you cannot afford a lawyer, one will be provided for you at government expense. Do you understand?
Earlier this month, the Supreme Court changed what suspects under interrogation should understand. Once suspects had to waive those rights for their words to be admissible as evidence. Now they have to declare they are exercising their right not to incriminate themselves. We all know the Miranda warning. We've heard it recited on TV hundreds of times. It's formality, a comforting confirmation that there is, in fact, law and order in the world. That's what shows like Law and Order and Hill Street Blues gave us. But NYPD Blue did not. David Milch wrote for Hill Street, but helped to create NYPD Blue. He wanted to make something more realistic, so he hired the best cop he could find, Bill Clark.
Bill said, if you show a guy getting his Miranda rights, I quit.
You're kidding.
Now, that doesn't mean that that was what Billy ultimately wanted, but what he was trying to do was disabuse me of the idea that the giving of Miranda is the norm. NYPD Blue tried to portray more realistically the living paradox of the cop situation, which is, we want you to deprive the suspect of as much of his constitutional rights as is necessary for society to function. And then we want you to lie to us.
Did that come up in the program?
Yes, it came up all the time. And it's usually associated with the idea of physical force being applied to the suspect to secure a confession. There's a scene in the first season where the more experienced detective is talking to a younger guy about when and if you beat a suspect, when and if you give him his Miranda rights, among others.
Let me put it to you like this. I never raise my hand to a guy if I think he's guilty or I'm trying to find out if he's guilty. But if I'm sure he's guilty and the case is going to walk, unless I raise my hand, I do what I got
to
do.
You've been willing to break the social contract, pal. And so am I.
How do you think Law and Order handled Miranda? They use it pretty regularly on that.
Yeah, that's none of my business.
Uh-huh. Okay. So you'd rather not comment on that program.
Right.
But you think that the impact of the constant invocation of the Miranda law that has enabled all of us who watch crime shows on TV to practically recite it word for word, like the Lord's Prayer.
Yeah, that is a dumbing down of the populace. And a cop who relies excessively and programmatically on the administration of Miranda at a given point, always the same point in a process, is a lousy cop. Every case, every arrest, every questioning has to be taken as sui generis, as its own thing. And you have to know when to give someone his rights and when, at a minimum, to give him the illusion that he's going to lose his rights unless he cooperates.
So the formality of the giving of the Miranda warning is the biggest fiction in a fictional program.
Thank you. Can you go to work? Can you help me later on?
David, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
David Milch was co-creator with Stephen Bochco of NYPD Blue. Susan Bandes is a professor of law at DePaul University. She's watched all 261 episodes of the show to study its use of the Miranda warning. She says the show is very real from the cop's perspective.
Miranda is something they have to get around, something that's keeping them from getting to the truth. And so the cop's job is to convince people that, in fact, it's in their interest to confess.
You want an attorney in here? I'll get you an attorney in here. He's going to tell you to shut up. And then things will become adversarial. The deal's gone. Forget the deal. Is that what you want? Us against you? Knowing what I know about you, you want me against you? I don't think so.
Cops tell the suspects that only they can be sure that if the suspect really acted in self-defense or really didn't know he was driving the getaway car or really felt remorseful, that only they can make sure that that story gets out. First of all, that simply isn't true. They'll have plenty of time to get their story out to their defense attorney, to a jury, to a judge. And second of all, cops are probably, as Miranda itself goes out of its way to tell them, they're adversaries in the situation, not their friends.
Can you recall a specific episode of NYPD Blue in which this issue came up?
One where it came up in a rather dramatic context was one where I believe it was a child molester or a suspected child molester, and the cops were very intent on catching him. And the quote was,
"Okay, you're asking me if I believe in the Constitution. Yes, I believe in the Constitution, and I hang on to that as long as I can. But in the case of a murderer like this who's going to walk, I leave my gun and my jewelry outside along with the Constitution."
And if you're wrong about this guy?
Well, then God forgive me.
You're a law professor. Have you done any trial work in which Miranda came up?
I did criminal appeals. I worked at the state appellate defender here in Illinois. So I did a lot of appeals in cases where it was pretty clear that people were convicted primarily or in some cases entirely based on their confessions when there was no physical evidence against them, for example. And people just did not hear the warning of Miranda.
Do you know that, in fact, they did actually hear a warning, that it was actually offered to them by the cops in every case?
In most cases, the cops do give the Miranda warnings. But what happens, and NYPD Blue is really good at depicting what happens, which is that the cops subvert the meaning of Miranda. They subvert the spirit. They say the words, but then they follow it with exactly what Sipowicz and Simone, I think, usually follow it with in NYPD Blue, which is, yeah, you know, you've heard these words and this is this kind of technical mumbo jumbo, but take it from us. If you really want to help yourself, you will talk to us. You won't go lawyering up. And so I would say that that's a very accurate portrayal of something that the cops do all the time.
In real life, people will confess to things they haven't done. In real life, the cops can be wrong.
That's right. We now know that people who are coerced in certain ways and told that they can't leave until they say certain things and deprived of sleep and sustenance will, in surprising numbers, confess to crimes they didn't commit. And so you're absolutely right. We never see that on NYPD Blue because on NYPD Blue, we have the viewer's privileged perspective. We know who committed the crime already, and we can see the cops moving closer to their appropriate suspect. We don't see the innocent person confessing, and we usually don't see the innocent person getting hauled into the interrogation room in the first place. And we're rooting, as the audience, for those niceties and technicalities like Miranda to be swept aside and to get the bad guy before he does more damage.
So TV isn't good for democracy.
I wouldn't go that far. And in fact, some people say it's the greatest education effort ever. Everyone knows their Miranda rights because they've all seen it on TV. There's a great story about some guy getting pulled over for a crime and saying, "You can't interrogate me. I know my rights." And the cop says, "Well, sir, this is Canada."
Susan, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Susan Bandes is a professor of law at DePaul University.
America has the highest incarceration rate in the world. And yet what we know about prison life comes from TV and movies, outsiders doing exposés, or interested parties using prisoners as signifiers of this or that. We rarely, if ever, hear from a prisoner. Until his release 5 years ago, Wilbert Rideau was jailed at the Louisiana State Penitentiary, known as Angola or The Farm, the largest maximum security prison in the United States. He was there for almost 50 years, convicted first of murder and released after serving a full term for what was eventually lessened to manslaughter. He also was, for 25 of those years, a reporter and eventually editor of The Angolite, a truly singular prison publication. He's written a memoir of his time as a prison journalist. It's titled In the Place of Justice, A Story of Punishment and Deliverance. Wilbert, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Let's start with why you were in prison. You took hostages during an armed robbery in 1961 and killed one of them, a woman named Julia Ferguson, when she tried to escape. You've never denied that crime, and yet the case went all the way to the Supreme Court. What were the circumstances?
I did kill the lady, and that's something I wish I could undo. I'll forever wish I hadn't done it. The Supreme Court declared my first trial a kangaroo court. I had absolutely no defense. The next two trials were pretty much the same until finally the fourth trial, a jury acquitted me of the murder and found me guilty of manslaughter. And since I served twice the amount of time, they freed me.
Now, you were on death row for more than a decade. Tell me about your days there.
Well, I was in a 6-by-8-foot cell alone. There's nothing to do. They would let me out twice a week for 15 minutes to take a shower. And I suspect the worst company you will ever want in life is yourself. You pace the floor, you do exercises, but you have to do something for your mind. So you begin reading, and that's the way I managed to survive that type of isolation, because man is a social creature. He's not meant to live alone. I learned empathy through reading. It caused me to understand the damage that I'd done to Julia Ferguson and even society.
Now, you were there for more than 10 years, but eventually found your way into the general population. And early on, you wanted to take some of your newfound literary thinking and work for the prison publication. Tell me what happened.
They refused. The prison paper, the jobs were officially reserved for white prisoners. The civil rights movement hadn't reached the prison yet.
This is in the early 70s.
Right. The administration was all white, and everything was defined by race. So I ended up sweeping floors. I recall reading in the newspaper one of the prison officials explaining the lack of blacks on the prison paper as being due to an inability to find blacks who could write. So I created an underground magazine. After a couple of issues, the administration put me out of business, and then I appealed to a chain of black weeklies in Louisiana, Mississippi, and asked them if they'd like for me to write a weekly column on prison called The Jungle, and they said, sure. Finally, the warden called me in one day in 1975. He was getting ready to leave, and he assigned me to The Angolite. He told me, it's yours.
Well, before we get to The Angolite, tell me about Lifer, all two issues of it, and tell me about your column, The Jungle. What was the content?
You have to understand, when I entered the general population, it was really a jungle. It was dog eat dog, and the biggest son of a bitch wins. Then the weak perished or served as slaves. Nothing in my life had prepared me for this, and I just knew the larger society didn't know what was going on. And if they knew, maybe they would straighten up all of this and reform the prison. Hey, since I could write, I was sort of duty-bound. I had to do this. I had to tell the world.
We've gotten to the Angelite now. This was an exiting warden's gesture to you. He said, all right, come join the prison magazine. Tell me about that experience.
Well, he literally gave me the newsletter at the time. I made it a magazine later. But the new warden who came in, C. Paul Phelps, he thought that a free press with investigatory powers and the freedom to print the truth, as the journalist says, he thought that that could make a difference. And as a result, we became the first and only uncensored prison publication in the United States history.
Was he interested in this kind of reporting for the benefit of those inside the walls of the institution, or was he also interested in it for the outside audiences like the legislature and so forth that mattered to him?
His interest was strictly the inside. His feeling was that most of the problems between prisoners and staff were generated by misconceptions of each other. There was a us-against-them world, and he made himself the publisher. And his orders to all staff was that as long as I was asking about the job you're doing, you had to provide the information, as long as it wasn't confidential high-security matters. And like he often said, there wasn't that much. Anything except personal files of inmates and personnel, they had to give it to us.
That is an extraordinary amount of access in any institution. Were you aware what kind of field of clover you were operating in journalistically?
Yeah, initially very dangerous because one part of my readership controlled every single day and thing I needed in life, whereas the other side of my readership, they're not given to letters to editors. If they didn't want me to wake up in the morning, I wouldn't. But we were critical of guards. We were critical of prisoners, too. And once people knew we were credible, once people knew they could trust us, once people knew we were going to be fair, they all took it on the chin.
Probably the most terrifying, eye-opening work you did was on the subject of sexual slavery. Inside, men are property of other prisoners.
Yes. You hear late-night comedians joking about it, but it was deadly serious matter in prison. Let me say this. The first thing I started writing about is not having enough toilet tissue in the prison, not having enough soap in a place that made soap. It's the little everyday problems we encountered. That's what I started writing about. The sexual thing, I'd never seen this. It was part of the security process. Anything that would divide prisoners, security wanted. You have to understand that up until that time, corrections officials had always depicted sexual violence as something that was an accident of prison or something that individuals did to each other because they were criminals. And it never had anything to do with the administration. And what I showed was that it had a lot to do with the administration. It had to do with the way they operated their prisons. I interviewed the corrections officials in Louisiana. I interviewed wardens as well as others, and they all told me the truth.
Well, apart from creating a bunch of unease in the administration and in cell blocks, tell me what effect it had in remedying the underlying conditions.
Well, it was like every other aspect of prison that we dealt with in the magazine. It educated everybody involved about the reality of what they were doing. It persuaded the authorities to stop locking up gay inmates as the cause of it because they were quite often the victims. And once everybody understood how it operated, it wasn't too long before sexual violence, while it didn't end, I mean, it probably never end, but it became rare for that type of thing to happen in Angola.
So what was the last 10 years like?
In 1995, a new warden took over, and he gradually began reimposing censorship. His thing was not to put us out of business. The objective was public relations. And the one thing that prison authorities have never been afraid of is the media going in and finding out anything, because a journalist from free society can walk through prison, see everything, and don't know what you're looking at. You don't know the right questions to ask. because it's a totally different world. The people who know the prison world the best are the inmates and the employees, which is why once you censor them, you're home free.
All right, Wilbert. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Wilbert Rideau is the author of In the Place of Justice, A Story of Punishment and Deliverance. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Vuolo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, and P.J. Vogt, with more help from Alex Goldman, Brett Jaspers, and Michael Chaplin, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Ellis Traver.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.